Welcome to Booktopia. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting across from Bob Carr, who's coming to talk about Run For Your Life, his memoir. I'm not nervous at all. It's just Bob Carr. I'm just going to take this quite relaxed. G'day, Mr. Bob Carr. How are you doing?
Very good to be at Booktopia.
It's, been a figure in my personal life for a long time. My parents would join you at the, what was it, Chester
A. Arthur Society, dedicated to American political trivia, but it became hard. As I say in this book, it became hard to maintain, in the chapter on America, it became hard to maintain that zest for American presidential trivia when we had an idiot president in George W. Bush.
Yep.
So we'd want to be talking about Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight D. Eisenhower and other serious American political leaders, as I say in the book, with the idiot grin of George W. Bush looking down at us. Now I think it's under even a greater challenge with someone who used to be on the stage for World Wrestling Entertainment, shaving the head of a wrestler, as president of the United States, the whole United States.
Yeah, so George W. Bush looks like a Bush.
Oh, serious statesman.
He looks like a great man. Good in comparison. So you've been a major figure within New South Wales politics, and then on the greater stage of this Australian politics as foreign minister. I'm looking at this book, and I'm thinking. I mean, last year I got to interview Mr. Rudd, and he only had volume one. It was a very big book. And your book is are you the David Hume of politicians and using being restrained by your modesty? You've done a lot. You're in power for a long, long time. How does one manage all the things that you've done in the writing process of a memoir? Because it's a kind of cut and paste.
Yeah, I think you've got to be ruthless at editing, and you've got to be prepared to do what, to my knowledge, no political memoirist is good at, and that is talk about your mistakes.
Yeah.
Say, this is something I regret. This is an encounter I got wrong. And I think you've got to edit out the things that might have happened, very likely might have happened anyway, and home in on where you brought your personality to bear. So I've tried to do that. I mean, there's one chapter called Better Humans Than We, which is about something I got involved in as a Minister for Environment, my first job in politics, and that was banning dolphinariums, making it against the law to take dolphins from the ocean and install them in small pools. It became an enthusiasm of mine. It became a passion of mine. And it forced me to go into a caucus, mainly suburban members of parliament, and say, we're talking here about an unusual issue, that is cruelty to other species and the capacity of dolphins, in this case, to suffer. And how do we bring the focus of the law to bear on that? And the sort of argument that I embraced as a 36-year-old minister, I'm not sure whether anyone else would have taken it up, but I'm very proud of what I did and what it meant.
So what you're saying is that there are all these events that are going on which may have happened anyway, and you're saying that the ones I'm going to concentrate on are the ones that I feel I had some agency involved in.
Yeah, it really made a difference. Like, I made a decision when I took over leadership of the Labor Party in New South Wales in a very dark time. We'd lost by a big margin. In 1988, I stick my head up as leader, and I make it very clear we're going to take a green policy direction. We will save the forests that were at risk in the New South Wales far south coast, the southeast forest. I stuck at that for 7 years and then had the wonderful experience. I mean, it was one of the experiences of my life, of taking power and saying, we're actually going to save more hectares than we promised to save when we were in opposition. We exceeded our promise.
So the opposite direction of most political promises.
Yeah. Okay. And we overfulfilled. Mm. You know, for people who are cynical about politics, I hope my book contributes to getting more young people interested in politics and committed to careers in politics. Here's an example of far from disappointing one's base, one got to overfulfill an election promise and push the whole agenda further than might have been the case. I did it. I'm not certain an alternative leader would have embraced that agenda.
Yeah. So, yeah, it is interesting with when looking back on a life, because, I mean, there are some lives, and mine, looking back, mine's very brief. I didn't sat in a bookshop for a long time, and then I didn't. Your life is full of all these wonderful things that and all these people you meet and all these events that you're involved in, struggles that are there. How do you keep that sense of your humanity or humility amongst all this? Because this is you're on the major stage. It's how do you keep grounded in that kind of?
Well, I'm not sure, but I say in one chapter, a short chapter, I think it's a one-page chapter about visiting Goulburn Jail, and I heard a voice from a cell say, "Hey, Bob, what are you going to do about the cockroaches?" Well, there was someone who was powerless, a prisoner in a cell in a Dickensian jail, an old brick and stone jail, one of the oldest in the state, hearing the Premier outside sending this telegraphed message, "Do something about the cockroaches." And I berate myself for not responding. Mm-hmm. I say, I disobeyed one of my own rules. In success, be kind. In defeat, avoid bitterness. Mm. Not a bad rule for someone in politics. If successful, be kind. If unsuccessful, avoid bitterness. Easier to give that advice than to pursue it. A harried premier doing a quick tour of a jail chose on that occasion to ignore the voice from the prison cell. Mm. And I was wrong to ignore that voice. I should have, a kinder person faced with that challenge, would have asked to have met the prisoner, to have seen the cell, to have heard about the cockroaches and made it very clear the administrators would clean it up.
Yeah. So this humanity is not easy to convey for politicians and their little sound bites and when you're in power, when you're being talked to by journalists and generally you've got on the Channel 9 news, you've only got a tiny little spot to get your bit across. What we often find is we get to know politicians better when they're out. Now, it's one of those, it must be so difficult, even if you're sitting at your desk and going, "I'm a real person, I've got these real emotions, I've got these real feelings." They don't know about any of it. You know, I can give them little bits and pieces here. I remember when I saw Ann Summers talking to Julia Gillard after she was out of power. And I'm thinking, where were you? Where were you? And she was there all the time. But this, the way that that fog of the media between me and her, and what she was allowed to get to me, what sort of messages she was able to get to me. Is that frustrating when, you know, we know you're a human. We know you're premier, you're foreign minister, but we just don't get to see it. And I mean, Wayne Swan complained about it to me here on this podcast about that inability to get cut across to the public directly.
Yeah, it is. And for someone who's battling an opposition, it's very frustrating. I talk in the book about the experience of opposition, and I hope in what people see as a funny chapter about the advice being served up by two worthy political professionals, Graham Richardson and Peter Barron, to my staff over a big meal and a long lunch in a Chinese restaurant in Sydney's Chinatown.
Why is it always a Chinese restaurant with you guys?
Always a Chinese restaurant with Labor guys, Cantonese restaurant.
Just down the road, isn't it?
And they were saying, "You've got to do something about this car. You've got an election coming up against Greiner in 3 months. His image is hopeless. He's way behind in the polls. You've got to get him out having a beer at the football." This was always the image that came up, "Get him out having a beer at the football." And my defenders, Chris Neal on my staff and John Della Bosca, party secretary and campaign director, said, "Well, it's got to be authentic." and me having a beer at the football would not have been authentic. And there was an interesting exchange, and I was rescued by an election campaign where we managed to hold the Labor vote, and the mob saw me as a winner, someone who could fight for them. And I learned a lot of lessons about politics from that. But I got a chapter on me and sport, short chapter. I have no reputation being keenly interested in sport, but there are a couple of sporting events that really got my juices flowing, but only a couple. It didn't matter in the end, because that sort of image making only works if through the X-ray medium of television your voters judge it to be authentic.
Mm.
And they didn't care that the Olympics were being managed by a premier who didn't go on golfing holidays and hadn't memorised the scores of great football events, turned up at the state of origin out of a sense of obligation, not out of keen personal interest. I think that chapter is very funny, but it does make a serious point. And that is, they'll judge you by what you deliver, not because you're trying to strike an image that might superficially appeal to people.
How hard is it to avoid being shunted into these by the image makers and the
well, you start and... you start getting into their heads that you should do certain things, and I think you've got to. I didn't always do it successfully. You've got to stand up to them and say, I'm not putting on the silly hat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go on the footy show. It'll be a disaster.
Yeah.
And generally, you don't get into trouble for saying no. But on the other hand, if you're doing these things at a time when your government's running strongly and your approval rating is high, you can absorb mistakes and bad judgment.
Yeah. And did you ever have to turn the image around? Did you ever find that you were stuck in one mode and you had to sort of undo it and try to...
Well, I talk about the sausage roll affair. I was in the middle of an election campaign and I was walking to a press conference. We were announcing a huge industrial park in Western Sydney. It was really substantial government work. And there were a couple of young journalists there and they were reading, this was breakfast time, very early in the morning, and they're eating sausage rolls, washing it down with full-strength Coke. And I said, hey, girls, that's not the healthiest breakfast. I mean, a sausage roll. And I forgot about it. The next day, I flicked on the radio, 6 o'clock in the morning, and the lead item was the state's pastry cooks furious at Premier Bob Carr. And I thought, what? What is this? And it turns out the Telegraph had played up the story. The Premier had lashed out at Australia's cuisine, the sausage roll, and they were furious. The phone goes, and my doleful media secretary, Amanda Lampy, says, I'm going to have to eat a sausage roll today. That's the media story. I was happy enough to go to the local pie store in my electorate and have a pie and sauce. Couldn't come at the sausage roll. But I found it a bit strange when a year later someone in the media said, look how manipulative Carr was. We want to talk about serious state issues.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
he elevated the sausage roll. I was innocent. As I say in the book, I was innocent as a snowdrop. It was the media that elevated the ridiculous sausage roll story.
You talk about your upbringing and the schooling that you had, and that you are very much a self-taught man, and you have not stopped. Like we were discussing earlier, you've been a frequenter of bookshops your whole life. You're a big reader. I mean, Mum and Dad would talk about you at the test day after meeting, just rattling off details about the Civil War and these kinds of as a self-taught person in this world of university students, and especially if you're facing down the Liberals all the time, you've got these educated people who probably don't read much anymore at all, but have the right
private school educations, in some cases, prestigious schools. Yeah.
Yeah. So is it, how big a part of reading, how big a part of your life is reading, and how did being so busy through a long part of your life affect your ability to get your reading time done? You know?
Yeah, I had a lousy education. I talk about it in the book, but I was indebted to a handful of teachers, an English teacher, Doris Allen in particular. And I reflect on how I would have loved to have done Latin. I've just come to you today from speaking to the Year 9 Latin class at North Sydney Girls High. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed talking to them about the Roman Empire and its resonance with Trump's America. But I suppose, bad as my education was, all those years of technical drawing and woodwork, when I would have loved to have studied a language or done ancient history at honours level, it did arouse a great love of learning in me that I've pursued as a big factor in my life, as if I've self-consciously been making up for a mediocre education.
So is that like catching up? Like you're just spending your time catching up?
I think so.
Yeah.
I would have loved to have had the Latin. I would have loved to have studied French and German and shunted around the grammar. I would have loved that stimulation. But I've been trying to reach some level of scholarship without the advantage of that grounding.
And what kind of reading do you do? Do you spend most of your time with history, or do you wander into fiction? Do you, like, what sort of reader are you, omnivore?
Yeah, I think I think because what's happening with Trump's America and what could be the decline of American power is so riveting that I'm reading more current affairs than I would have in the past. Mm-hmm. So I've just read Edward Luce's book on the retreat of liberal democracy.
Yep.
And any good analysis of what's happening in the US strikes me as being very important now as we respond to the showmanship of Trump, his populism, his vulgarity, his ignorance, and his improvisation. I like fiction, but I won't waste my time on a novel that I think is, like a lot of modern fiction, is striving for effect and being too clever. Henry Kissinger said to me once, how nice it is to drop a name, quite as gold-plated, that he can only read historical fiction. And we're talking about the novels of Colin McCulloch, the big Roman novels, the seven of them, which I invoked when I was talking to the young ladies at North Sydney High a little time ago.
Yeah, the name drop back. My school friend is Michael Fully Love, and Michael Fully Love had that on the front of his book. And my mum's always pitted me against him, and to try and beat him with a Kissinger quote on the front of your book is it's quite tough.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
When you look back on your time in politics, you know, both federal and state level, what are the things that you wish you were able to change? Things that just were kept getting out of your reach, and you thought we could probably get there, we could probably get that, and we didn't get to change that.
Yeah. The big one is privatisation of electricity. Mm-hmm. I put it to my party in my first term. I think it was something of a fluke that I wasn't able to get it through. The normal pattern is for a bit of resistance, the left to go down, leading a charge at a conference, but to accept the inevitability that a cabinet should get its way, especially on a big matter of economic management. But the party didn't enable me to do that, and as a result, it was the unions opposed to it simply conferred the bonanza, the opportunities for public investment, on a coalition government rather than a Labor government, and as it happens, one that went on to squander the proceeds. We've got a light rail out to our part of Sydney where we live that no one wants because we've got a perfectly adequate bus service. Now, the light rail is absorbing, at this stage, $3 billion, and it won't increase the public transport capacity. It'll force more changes in the journey, which is a disincentive to use public transport rather than a private vehicle.
Yeah. So that's a major one. What about in as foreign minister? Was there anything there where you What was that? What was that like? Did you feel like you had hands tied behind your back, or was it like, what was the
experience? No, I'm very, very proud that I shifted the government's position on Palestine, on how we vote at the UN when it comes to the status of the Palestinian delegation. That was a big battle because Julia Gillard, despite her other qualities, was so close to the Melbourne Israel lobby. I've got a chapter. It might be provocative in my book called "Me and the Lobby," about me and my battles with the Israel lobby, which I think is important recording for the record. I was very pleased with the victory I mobilised, and I've gone on, and I record this in the book, to consolidate it outside Parliament, where I've shifted the position of Labor Party conferences on Palestinian recognition. I would have liked to have been Foreign Minister from 2007, where I would have had a chance of entrenching relationships, especially with Southeast Asia.
Right. And finally, your current role with looking after, or I don't know how you describe your current role, but with the China...
Yeah. I'd say illuminating. Our job's a think tank, that of a think tank. Yeah. And it's to illuminate the Australia-China relationship.
Because there's been some... there's a recent book that was yep. saying that they were all coming down to get us. And you've been involved with the China-Australia relationship for some time. China is changing rapidly. What is China now? I mean, they talk about the Communist Party. They talk about... But, you know, it doesn't look much like a Communist Party as we would consider it in the whole frame. Is it unravelling? Is it setting up something else? Is it change? Are we in a moment of change with it?
Well, there's a lot of life in China that's outside the control of the Communist Party, although its surveillance is stronger rather than weaker than what it was in the 1990s. But we would deny ourselves a lot of advantages if we take the view promoted by the anti-China Taliban, that's what I call them, the anti-China Taliban, generating wave after wave of anti-China panics in Australia, if we took the view that it's communist-controlled and they're our enemy.
Yeah.
So Clive Hamilton's book says China's the enemy of Australia and they've got territorial ambitions on us. All this is evidence-free, of course, contradicted by so much we know of the nature of China and its relationship with the world. The challenge is for us to accept how Gough Whitlam framed this. He said in 1973, we aspire to a relationship with China comparable to that which we've got with other great powers. Mm. And the test for Australia is whether, while being an ally of the United States, we can give ourselves that relationship with China, despite all the pressure from America, despite the pressure from our own security services, who don't want us to move one iota from a rusted-on alliance with the US, and despite the challenges that China's own behaviour presents from time to time. So the idea of having that kind of relationship with China that Whitlam laid down as desirable is the thing.
So from my distant and ignorant perspective, I do get the impression that with the opening up of the economy in China, with the westernization of China, with its involvement with Western business, with greater freedoms in the large cities, and wealth sharing, that it was that. Who was the fellow that said that no two countries who had McDonald's went to water? But this level of the middle class rising then softens the effect of. Is that something that's actually happening?
Despite the tightening of surveillance and the limitation on internet freedom that you've seen under President Xi, I am confident that China becoming a predominantly middle-class society, it's on track to do it by 2025, 5 years earlier than people were saying this year. People were predicting this year. The updated scenario is 2025, not 2030. They will admit another 850 million to middle class income status between 2012 and 2030, or just possibly 2025. Mm. Now that is astonishing. It's never happened before in human history. In a challenge to us Liberal Democrats, it's happening without multi-party democracy. Yeah. It'd be nicer for us if it were happening. But in the meantime, China is not required to ask Australia's permission, the permission of people in right-wing think tanks or the head of ASIO in Canberra, to do this. They're hauling their people out of poverty, thank you. And they're doing it because it's in their interests. It's their destiny. And in the meantime, the public sector, measured as a proportion of its total workforce, is smaller than Australia's public sector. So don't tell me there's not a transformation occurring. Mm. They're less dependent on the state and less dependent on the party. And unlike any other communist society, 100 million travel overseas each and every year for business, tourism. And as students, 100 million are allowed out. Every previous communist power has said, no, we can only run this place by building a Berlin Wall and preventing people leaving. You cannot leave if you're born in the Soviet Union. This is where you stay unless the party trusts you enough to let you out. China's different. So don't tell me that it's not capable of further change and it's not a relationship we should pursue. We should pursue the relationship despite all the challenges of dealing with a one-party state, and not subject ourselves to these China panics. Every day in the papers, there's a headline based on a China panic narrative. Chinese communists are coming here. They've got a secret plan to put a base in Vanuatu. There's no evidence of that. They've only got one base outside China. It's in Djibouti. Why would they put their second one in the South Pacific, where they've got virtually no trade, no sea lanes of communication? And no, neither Vanuatu nor Australia nor China are saying there's going to be a base there. But nonetheless, we have headlines, waves of China panic, which is best understood, and I argue this in my chapter on China, as a panic attack to the displacement of America. Because in 2030, China's going to have an economy twice the size in purchasing power terms of that of the United States.
Astonishing.
It is astonishing. And the shift in power is occurring. And for Australia, so wedded to the American alliance, this is a shock. It's a trauma. And for people who run the pro-American think tanks in Canberra or an Australian security service, it is doubly a trauma when you have Donald Trump, this boy emperor, this monkey king, running wild in the US and trashing America's alliances. In 1 week, he derides America's close ally, Canada, and embraces a true Marxist dictator in Chairman Kim of North Korea.
Bob, if I was being selfish, I would sit you here and just keep talking to you, but no, I'm going to wrap this podcast. There's so many things we can go into. Thank you so much for coming in and having a chat with us.
It's been a great honour, and the book Run For Your Life is available from Booktopia and from all local bookstores.
That's my line, Bob, but I'll let you have it. Thank you. Thanks. That's been Bob, the Booktopia podcast. Thanks very much for listening.
Good, John. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.